Welcome to Your Money Today, a unique look at financial, geopolitical, and other news relevant to you. For 45 years now, your host, Chris Temple, has provided his one-of-a-kind insights and advice on the markets and on our world. Whatever the subject, he calls them like he sees them. Roll up your sleeves with Chris as we get into today's program.
Welcome back, folks. I'm recording this on Monday evening, the 2nd of March. This is after the first full trading day here in, well, really world markets, but of course culminating here in North American markets after the combined Israeli and U.S. attack on Iran that unfolded starting early in the hours, I guess, on Saturday. And what I want to do here is not flog a lot of talking points, especially some of the partisan ones you've already heard probably too much of in these early days, and you're going to hear a lot more of in the weeks and unfortunately probably months to come as this whole saga continues to evolve. But I want to, as always, cut through the partisanship, cut through the sound bites from whoever side you happen to be on, or anybody happens to be on. And again, as I always do, look at this thing coldly, mathematically, dispassionately. It's hard to do that in some ways right now. And kind of try and figure out what we're going to be dealing with. Now, to a great extent, of course, we can't possibly know everything we're going to be dealing with. We don't know how serious and how capable still Iran is of retaliating. We do know that contrary to his insistence and of those around him and those who supported him on a part of President Trump, that he's against regime change wars. This is now the second one of Trump 2.0. The first one removed the leader of Venezuela, and this one, of course, just killed all of the top leadership, including Khamenei of Iran. And so now we're going to be looking at somewhat of a power vacuum over there in some respects, and God only knows what the outcome is going to be. And that's the first thing I think that we need to understand when we're trying to figure out what the markets are going to do, how much this is going to reverberate among the global economy, what different assets are going to do, of course, most notably in this case, energy prices, is to get our heads around the unfortunate truth that this is not a quick hit and run operation like the president and the Israelis pulled off last June when they told us that they had destroyed that country, Iran's nuclear capabilities. They either did no such thing, or Iran has the best scientists known to mankind and was rebuilding it quickly, or it was just time to decapitate the leadership. There's been a lot of that talk about that out there in the last couple of days or so. So, and as I go through this too, you know, look, I'm one of those who, as I've said many times, I don't look at this from Trump derangement syndrome standpoint or Trump deification syndrome's standpoint. This country and its people have been lied to by presidents from both parties about all different kinds of wars in the past. A couple of instances I'm going to get to later on that concerns China. That's one of the more concerning and least covered things about this attack on Iran, and now the resulting question mark over how much oil and fertilizer is going to flow through the Strait of Hormuz and possibly elsewhere. But look, for all of the excuses, good, bad, or indifferent, as to why this happened, it did. And it's as I have commented so many times when it comes to talking about Fed policy and the markets and things like that. If I had my druthers, and a lot of other people I think are in this camp, we would not have a Federal Reserve. If we didn't have a Federal Reserve, in my opinion, we arguably would not have a lot of the problems we have economically in our country, nor would we have the ability for the U.S. to have this open-ended credit card, thanks to the Fed, by which we have waged war and troublemaking the world over for many, many decades now. So when it comes to that, as much as I have to hold my nose sometimes to do it, I have to necessarily address the markets and what we do as investors and how we have to look at things as consumers within the context of, like it or not, we have this flawed system called the Federal Reserve and the system it presides over. You're going to hear more about that in the coming several days from me, as I've been promising for a while. Likewise, whatever lies have been told, whatever promises have been broken by the president and others, the fact is we now have embarked on this regime change war where Iran is concerned. No one's shedding a tear, certainly not me, for the mullahs over there. I think that there's a lot still we're not being told. As with Venezuela, it is conceivable that the people of Venezuela and now Iran ultimately will be better off perhaps than they were before we went in with what the Democrats are calling an illegal war and what a lot of President Trump supporters are calling a betrayal. So those opinions on both sides aside, this is what we have right now. This is the hand that we have been dealt as consumers, who are now going to be paying a lot more for gasoline in the days ahead. It's the hand we've been dealt as investors, where now uncertainty and a lot more risk has been piled onto markets that were already over their skis, already overpriced, already ignoring a lot of other problems in the world, and now might be pushed over the edge if all of a sudden, contrary to the promises the president is making, we end up in a prolonged quagmire where Iran is concerned. Don't forget that, among others, Vice President Dick Cheney, who was really the brains behind the whole operation, promised us at the outset of the Iraq War that he and George Bush Jr. presided over, that this would be over in a matter of weeks. It went on for years, cost trillions of dollars. So have many other things that we've got involved with, unfortunately, in years past. And obviously, we've not learned our lesson. Now, do I believe that President Trump, in his mind, thinks that he's going to do something different and he's doing the Iranian people and the world a favor, the U.S. in the long run, by nipping this long-simmering problem in the bud? Yeah, he probably does believe that. Do I trust the people who are whispering in his ear telling him that? No. But again, that's another story, and it's where we're at right now. Now, I'm going to throw a bit of a curve in here and discuss something that has been very little discussed in relative terms in the first two plus days, whatever it's been, of this war with Iran. And that is a bigger issue of, generally speaking, what I've described for a while now as a World War III over commodities and currency and global influence on the world chessboard, that just took a big new step forward as far as this war is concerned with this move against Iran. And the specific element of that, and the biggest element of that, being the strategic and economic and other jockeying back and forth, to use a kind term, simmering conflict might be more accurate, between the world's two big powers today, being China and the U.S., economic powers, of course, I mean, chiefly. Now, according to some of his detractors and people who believe that President Trump doesn't know what he's doing and was, you know, cajoled into this whole thing by Benjamin Netanyahu and Lindsey Graham and those of their ilk, without really realizing what the quagmire is that we could end up in Iran with, I think, likewise, I have to question, and we're going to find this out in the coming days, the extent to which the president understands what this move against Iran means for the conflict, which is a soft war right now, between the U.S. and China. We already know that last year, when President Trump and President Xi of China got together, that President Trump, contrary to his public assertions, essentially had his ass handed to him, as I reported at the time, with multiple details of what was agreed to and promised at that meeting. China continues to still have leverage over the U.S., over finished rare earth products and a whole host of other commodities. The U.S. is moving, of course, as many of you know, to try and get off of that dependence on China for a lot of different critical materials. But this is something that's going to take many, many years, if not decades, to fully accomplish. And in the meantime, we remain vulnerable, where, of course, the U.S. has China over a barrel somewhat, is on some of the higher tech chips and things like that, and other technology which they want to be able to buy. That is what they don't steal already in one way or another from the U.S. So that's an issue. And of course, also the Chinese economy is in very big distress at the same time that Donald Trump, contrary to his claim at the State of the Union and otherwise, pretty much having licked inflation, it's been moving higher again, not lower. It's going to move a lot higher now with this whole thing now with Iran, although now we've got a scapegoat, of course, just like Joe Biden had his Putin price hike, on which he blamed the soaring price of gasoline over that war that we helped to instigate. Likewise, Trump and his minions, no question, you'll start to hear some of the talking points that the higher inflation and less affordability for American consumers is all the fault of this moolah that's now in the afterlife with the 72 virgins or vegetarians or whatever the hell he's been promised. In contrast to that, China has been valiantly fighting off a debilitating deflation for some time now. Their 10-year yields for Chinese government bonds are less than half the yield of what a 10-year treasury is, because people think that's a good deal, with deflation still the big story in China. It doesn't take much when you're in that position, already having trouble servicing debts, already with massive overcapacity and the rest. It's not going to take much to push China over the edge. And I have referred to this numerous times in the past, folks, but it's my view that there are a lot of the old guard of the neocons in the government in Washington who have been in both Democrat and Republican administrations, some at the State Department, certainly some at the CIA, who would like nothing more than to topple China economically. And you need to consider, and President Trump needs to consider, what he has just done in 2026 to really essentially attack China economically. And that's not an overstatement to say that. You know, about a fifth of China's overall oil imports, which are about 11.5 million barrels a year, about a fifth of that last year came from Venezuela and Iran. China has been willing, in their challenge long term to the U.S. global hegemony, to buy discounted oil from both of those countries, and some of it through intermediaries, some of it directly, using their currency, the renminbi, as currency to help get it more traction in global trade markets, etc. And now, in two successive actions, President Trump has, in a way, taken that oil away from them, that cheap oil away from them. Does that mean China can't buy it anyplace else? No, but now they've got to pay up considerably more for it. World wars have started over things like this. Don't ever forget, whatever you want to believe about the conspiracy theories of whether President Roosevelt or someone in his administration knew ahead of time that the attack on Pearl Harbor was coming on December 7, 1941, there is little qualms over the idea and the fact, historically, that what caused trouble between the U.S. and Japan in the first place was the U.S. essentially cutting off energy to Japan with a blockade and embargo to that country. And that was what was pretty much strangling Japan. Now, do we have something to that extent that's going to that debilitate China right now? No, of course we don't. But we have a move in that same direction. And so this is, as much as anything, going to dictate, I think, the longer term course of the economy and some of these commodity prices, is what China's response to this is going to be. You know, literally, as I took a break in recording a few segments of this very podcast, I went back out in my living room, and I've got the TV muted right now, and I turned it back on, and Gordon Chang, who's a big China expert, not a very friendly China expert, you know, doesn't trust them, doesn't like that country, and particularly its government, but he was on, and he pointed out, and I've heard this before, but not in the detail he gave this evening, that China in the recent past sent something like a dozen and a half big cargo planes to Iran, supposedly with components of offensive weapons of some kind on those planes. So really, we're, you know, kind of like U.S. weapons being used by NATO, being used by Ukraine against Russia. Here in Iran, and this has probably been the case already, we've got, to some extent, Chinese-made weapons being used in retaliation against the Israelis and the U.S. and bases over there and that kind of a thing. So this is something, again, that I think we need to talk about and watch more in the coming days. As many of you know, there's a meeting scheduled on March 31st in Beijing between Trump and President Xi. And who knows, maybe, you know, I think every time I hear that the president is really employing 5D chess when he breaks campaign promises, we've all got to hold our nose and trust him. That's getting very, very old. But I'm curious as hell to hear what the game plan is for him to now think he has a much stronger hand to go and talk to President Xi in Beijing and say, look, now we've cut off your cheap oil that's helping you out and so forth and all that kind of thing. But this is all, again, a part of that broader, as I've called it, World War III over commodities and currencies and over the geopolitical balance of power in the world. And it's going to continue to evolve, and I hope it's going to do it more peacefully, notwithstanding what we probably have coming in Iran. Moving back to Iran generally, and necessarily the Strait of Hormuz specifically, it was announced this afternoon by Iran's Revolutionary Guard that it has, quote, closed the strait. That was, frankly, a bit anticlimactic for those who had followed the news previously since really yesterday, because what was already happening is that, and I put out a couple of really good things on social media this morning that if you haven't looked at it, go back and read them. It explains the economics behind all of this. You know, while Iran did hit one or two vessels in the strait ahead of the official announcement that they consider the strait closed and will attack shipping in the strait, it had effectively already happened to a great extent, because what you already had occurring was that insurers like Lloyd's of London, shipping companies like Maersk and others, Golar LNG for the LNG part of things, is that they were already jacking both insurance premiums and shipping costs way up to obviously counteract the much heightened risk now of shipping those things. I mean, Lloyd's of London doesn't want to write a check for the full value of a cargo of crude oil or refined products for that matter. They would rather collect a premium to insure it, but even there, they're demanding much more of a premium because of the increased risk. And look, both J.P. Morgan and I think Wells Fargo was one, and I think J.P. Morgan was the other one that came out today. I may be mistaken on the second, but Wells Fargo for sure said all you need to do is pretty much have the Strait of Hormuz effectively shut down for a month. And their outlook on that would be that would take oil back to $100 on the spot market, and it would push the S&P 500 down to 6,000 or in that neighborhood. That they think that's the worst case scenario, but it's something that needs to be contemplated again, especially if we're going to be looking at multiple weeks, if not months, as this thing goes on. The Saudis had their main refinery hit by Iran. Qatar had an LNG shipper, I think, that was also hit. So Iran clearly is of a mind that if they can't win this war, and there's no way, of course, they can win militarily in the end, they want to exact as much of a cost on the part of those who are attacking them and the rest of the world as they can get away with. How far this goes remains to be seen. We need to consider that there are a couple of players in the Middle East who have already indicated that they want to join forces with Iran, the Houthis in Yemen being at the top of the list, but Hezbollah, of course, they've reared their head again as well. So there were some skirmishes in recent hours between the Israelis and Hezbollah. fortunately, in the grand scheme of things, the net result is that even most of the neighbors of Iran have no love lost for them, don't like them, don't get along with them, and even Saudi Arabia, as I may have mentioned already, I forgot already, has warned that, you know, this attack on their refinery and causing the Saudis to have to shut down a refinery that processes something like 600,000 barrels of crude oil a day all by itself, that the Saudis may be shoulder to shoulder with Israeli and U.S. military in this offensive against Iran. So again, we don't know what the outcome is going to be. Nobody does, unless you have that tricked out DeLorean that I'm always pining for, so I can jump into the future and be able to look back and see exactly what happened. All we can do is look at the facts and the reality in front of us, look at probabilities, and do the best we can. As consumers, we're going to have limited options, that's for sure. The only option being is to pay more for gas or drive less if we don't want to blow out our household budgets, because at least for a while, that's going to be a reality. And again, especially if this thing goes beyond President Trump's fairly short timeline, we do end up having boots on the ground, or we do end up with more of a broad regional conflict. I mean, that really, to me, seems a little far-fetched. Nothing's impossible, but it seems a little far-fetched. But whatever the outcome, there's no question that we're going to have more angst, more tension in the world, certainly more inflation. And especially if things turn bad, don't forget what I repeated a couple of times recently that I think bears repeating now. And I hope things don't get this dire. Although we did have this purported murder in Texas this weekend of somebody apparently influenced by his love for the jihadis and hatred for the U.S. that killed a couple people, wounded many more. God forbid we have more of that going on in this country. But don't forget, and I'll say it again, I can't repeat it enough so that you understand how these things work, regrettably, in our powerful world with evil people wielding a lot of that power. On September the 10th, 2001, we already had a bear market on Wall Street for well over a year. The bubbles that were blown, chiefly by Alan Greenspan in the 90s, were losing their air. He was already being vilified by that time, finally regarded as mortal, not the maestro after all, but a screw-up who created way too much speculation and speculative new financial instruments in the 90s, all in the name of modern money mechanics and this kind of thing. Likewise, President George W. Bush, who came into office just as this was getting set to happen, you know, he's the guy that's in there, so right or wrong, the recession and bear market are his fault. And he's being ridiculed. You know, he's a lightweight. He's just an idiot frat boy who's only president because of his name, etc. That was a story on September 10th, 2001. On September 11th, that all changed. And now the bear market, which got progressively worse, the recession, which also ended up getting progressively worse, were no longer the fault of Bush or Greenspan or anybody who had mismanaged our markets or economy. It was the fault of 19 terrorists. And they've played that card before. They'll play it again. Maybe they're getting set to play it again now. President Trump certainly will blame the gasoline price increases to come on everybody but himself for having gone in. And again, even if you got a good outcome in this war, we hope for everybody's sake, we're going to be seeing higher energy prices and ultimately higher inflation. This whole affordability thing I'll get to in a minute, you know, is not going to really be looking very good for him in the near term. Now, few investment specific thoughts as we wind down and then end with a couple of political considerations that are going to be increasingly at play here. First of all, my gut told me last night when we saw the futures markets open and the stock market was going to go down to not chase any of those initial moves. And of course, that was the right thing to do, was to do nothing, as the day turned out. Will that stay the same case? Probably not. In fact, if you put a gun to my head and I had to tell you the one move today, even if it came off of its more extreme level, that has got the greatest chance of having some durability it will be the price of crude oil. Secondarily, some of the more leveraged producers might do well, because I don't think this is going to go away quickly enough to cause this or allow for this to simply be a flash in the pan type of thing where, you know, as soon as the conflict starts, everybody, you know, reverses and the war related move or whatever is over, you know, pretty much before it starts. I appreciated what Eric Nuttall said this morning. He's an energy analyst with Nine Point up in Canada, really sharp guy. And I want to read you one of the things he said this morning, which again, this is what usually is the case, but maybe not this time. He said, quote, "My typical playbook is to sell geopolitical spikes. This time feels different. Iran striking its regional neighbors was unexpected and massively escalatory, putting oil infrastructure at risk and making insurance on vessels through the strait for now uneconomic. Without decisive regime change, it's reasonable to expect an enduring risk premium in the oil price, greater than what we've historically seen, and especially with the twilight of shale and rapid OPEC spare capacity exhaustion happening in real time. For equities, this is coinciding with a massive rotation out of tech and software and into hard assets, including energy, with the energy sector still out of favor and underowned. What to own? Long life, high margin, low growth, high free cash flow assets in politically safe jurisdictions." So, needless to say, we'll be augmenting ours in just the coming few days. Our members at the National Investor, of course, will be apprised of that. We've already got a pretty decent exposure to what I've called old energy, you know, being oil and gas producers, pipelines, that type of thing. And I'll be looking to bump that up. And again, it's going to be a little bit risky to do that. You're going to have to, you know, have one foot near the exit door in case things do settle down faster than how things appear at present. But again, that seems to be the most enduring. One of the things I find interesting, though, is that, you know, the initial reaction, and I want to bring gold into this conversation as well. You know, during the early days of when Russia went into Ukraine back 4 years ago now, you had a big and immediate move in the energy prices, but not much in gold. Gold really wasn't back on the map yet as a monetary and reserve asset in a big way, nor the first place people go for geopolitical worries. Gold is getting more love recently, though, so I think it'll do halfway decent. Don't forget that unlike crude oil, which was pretty much on a bearish back foot in the recent past because of fears of oversupply, fears that the world economy is going to slow down, including the U.S. economy. And I think all of those were overdone. I already liked the fundamental setup for oil and natural gas, both long-term, before this. I like it better now. Gold, in contrast to that, has been a full-throated alternative currency again and reserve asset again. Unlike any of the base metals, even silver, which has been more erratic and which I would be concerned about, quite honestly, right now, much more than I would the gold price. So, you know, the factors that prior to this weekend and the attack on Iran, the factors that have gold very bullish long term are all still in place. The wild card in the days ahead is going to be the Fed. Because if the realization grows, and you know I've been talking about this for a while and have warned that the Fed is very unlikely to loosen monetary policy, particularly at short-term interest rates, very much, if at all, this year. And as I predicted at the beginning of the year, the Fed just said, several of its members, that they are in favor of telling the public that, hey, there's a two-way risk here. If inflation bubbles up too much more than it already has, we may raise interest rates again. Don't forget that that's a big part of gold's move in a recent past, is this idea. And it's the same idea that's undergirded the stock market and a lot of other risk assets, that the Fed was going to be uber easy on monetary policy. We're not going to get that. So there is some near-term risk where you've got to be a little bit more judicious about gold at 5,300 than you were when gold was 2,300. That, I mean, simple math to tell you that, but here again, long-term picture is still great. We're going to make all-time highs down the road, but it's going to take a lot more serious damage in this war to scare people into gold in a much bigger way, because I think the narrative is going to grow that we're going to see the Fed really removed from any ability to help things out if inflation continues to percolate, So, and this really is the setup that we had before this weekend and before this move into Iran. We had the president, President Trump, losing his tariff case at the Supreme Court, but staying belligerent. And he's going to impose a 10% global tariff on everybody. Then he quickly upped it to 15%, threatening other countries who want to back out of deals they had previously under the tariffs that were, or threatened tariffs that were declared illegal by the Supreme Court. Stagflation is setting in even more, which introduces downside risk to economic growth, which I think a lot of the middle class and sub-middle class in America has already seen. At the same time, we've got a lot of cracks opening up in the credit markets. Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan has been very vocal lately about all of the different risks he's seen. He said that his anxiety is very high right now. That's been chiefly over the cracks that have appeared in private credit. Recently, the whole Blue Owl thing that I've mentioned to you in recent days, if you hadn't read it already. And he was out with an interesting quip again just today, warning, and now this is going to be worsened by higher energy costs, gasoline, etc., warning about inflation even more than he had previously, and saying that it's set up to be the skunk at the party, he said, for the U.S. economy going forward. And certainly for President Trump and this whole affordability thing. Before I close with that, though, I want to point out a few things. One of the reasons why in recent days, even though there have been a few instances where it looked, boy, finally the stock market's getting ready to break down in a bigger way, it hasn't. I've not really changed up our overall asset allocation model with our members at the National Investor. We have incrementally been taking a lot of profits, selling off a few losers as well, to go from almost a zero cash position, late summer, early fall time frame, 0 to 5 or 6%, depending on whether you're a conservative investor or, following my more aggressive mix, to recently 25 to 30% cash on average, because I wanted to have a little bit better position. If we do get a more sustained downturn, we have some modest market contrary positions right now, not very much. But I've been reticent about doing anything beyond that, because every time you think the stock market's ready to break down, it doesn't. I posted a few things on that again in recent days, too, with a couple of charts of the S&P 500 that I put out on social media. You always want to follow me at least on Twitter and LinkedIn. I still call it Twitter, X, and LinkedIn, I should say. But you look at the charts, and we're still going sideways for the stock market. There is no technical confirmation yet, and not sufficient enough damage, with the exception of, some individual stocks that got over their skis in software and AI and things like that. But fairly remarkably, there's still enough liquidity and still enough wishful thinking in the markets that it hasn't really affected the market in a bigger way. So the charts sure haven't told you to either sell or buy more with this narrow range we've been in for stocks. The really weird one has been the chart of the 10-year Treasury, because you may remember it wasn't that long ago that the 10-year Treasury, which I had said was in this 4 to 4.2% range, broke above 4.2% and kept going. Still, though, I didn't feel right to try and trade that by shorting Treasuries, which already had high short positions. Then all of a sudden, over the last couple or 3 weeks, you blinked your eyes, and boom, down we go. And the reaction low yield in the 10-year Treasury overnight was something like 3.93%. And of course, Treasuries typically and historically have been one of the first flight to safety assets whenever you have things like this kind of a global conflict or whatnot break out. The fact that you had such a monster rally in the yield and sell-off in Treasuries, though, today, is the day went on is telling, and I think that's going to remain one of the core stories, even though we may see some buying that will keep things from, really coming unhinged with U.S. Treasuries. the higher now inflation risks, the ever higher debt, and God only knows how much President Trump is going to blow out the budget even more as he lends the Israelis a hand by whipping their neighbor Iran, hated neighbor Iran. God only knows how much more the debt's going to go up this year than the 1.6 or 7 trillion, whatever it was slated to do in the first place. So in closing, with the exception again of old energy in some respects, as I alluded to a few minutes ago, I wouldn't be going too hog wild on just about anything quite yet. I think that if we do see a quagmire start to develop and we get boots on the ground and so forth, we probably will see those types of things is one or too many, two straws on the stock market camel's back, and it will be wise to more aggressively take the contrary side or the downside by shorting the stock market in different ways. We'll talk about that when the time comes, and of course I'll give those recommendations to my members at the National Investor. But in closing, you know, there are already a number of ways in which President Trump has really been disappointing his base, a lot of the incremental people that swung over and vote for him. They're very silent publicly, at least right now. Of course, they have to be in his administration unless they're ready to resign. But people like Robert Kennedy and Tulsi Gabbard and even Vice President Vance, to some extent, these were all people who were very much against and seemingly more sincerely so foreign entanglements than even Donald J. Trump was before they all took office back a year ago in January. And so now you've got a situation where already, as I've discussed in other contexts in the recent past, President Trump has really made hash out of the chance of the Republican Party to keep both the House and the Senate in the midterm elections this year. The only thing they really have going for them, frankly, is that the Democrat Party is in such disarray and so crazy and just crackpots and anything to do with opposing Trump. I mean, it's very transparent. And of course, Republicans do it too. I don't want to put it all on them. But, you know, heaven help the Democrats if the outcome that we all hope happens, and that is that this thing is over in several weeks, like the president has said. We don't suffer many more casualties. We don't end up with boots on the ground. And Iran gets put back together a lot faster than probably is looks realistic right now. If those things happened, on top of everything else, next to all of the Republicans' TV ads in the fall, showing all the Democrats in the House chamber sitting on their hands when President Trump asked them whether they regard the safety of American citizens is more important than that of illegal aliens. And of course, that was a great setup for campaign advertising. Next to that will be all the Democrats who were hysterical over the president going into Iran. Now look, as I said at the outset, do I want to see something like this? No. But we've got to deal with the world in which we live, which unfortunately was made a mess in the past by the United States, where Iran is concerned. They're not the only case, of course, in history. And so we've got to deal with what we need to deal with. So the risks this fall, besides losing his tariff case and getting more belligerent over that and all of the other things, you know, that the president has said that are really ringing hollow with a big swath of the American public, you know, again, this appears to be the case when the inflation numbers get worse, which some of them are going to do anyway, as the year goes on. He's going to blame it on the whole war in Iran, and we never would have had this, it's all Barack Obama's fault. Oh, he always has to throw in Barack Hussein Obama's fault for sending all those pallets of cash to Iran, and for him and Biden both being soft touches when it came to Iran. And we never would have got to this point had it not been for them. So the prices at the gas pump were also their fault. He'll talk about that. His handlers will tell him that, and his adherents will repeat that on the conservative media and so forth. He'll seek to isolate the Democrats for their, supporting everybody but Americans, in this case, Iran. So there'll be some things that he'll be able to capitalize on. But here again, historically, elections have always been decided more than any other issue, for the most part, by economics, by people's pocketbooks. You know, it's like Bill Clinton was famously told when he was running, it's the economy, stupid. You know, nobody cared about Iraq and what George Bush Sr. had accomplished when it came to finishing the work Ronald Reagan started by sending the Soviet Union into the dustbin of history or any of the rest of that stuff. People were hurting. They didn't like the economy. The costs were too high. And that's how things turned out. That's how people voted. They're going to vote that way this November as well. So there's a very risky economic calculus, an electoral calculus that President Trump and his people have taken. You know, he's trying to take the high ground now, saying, I know this is going to be unpopular, but I've got to do the right thing. And look, if it works out for him and for all the rest of us, God bless him. Maybe they'll find a fifth spot on Mount Rushmore for him after all. But, you just have to wonder about this sudden influence that's only growing on a part of the traditional neocon cabal that's been in Washington. You know, the people like the Lindsey Grahams of the world who, I mean, we're just starting Iran, and now Lindsey Graham is running his mouth about Cuba's next. So, I mean, these guys really love war, and they love the American empire. They want to further the American empire, and, you know, on the surface, Donald Trump certainly has violated his campaign promises. He's made the job of really fixing our economy in a right way, he's made it harder for himself. And, we can only hope that it does end that way. But again, I could ramble on about politics and my opinions, but I won't tax your patience any longer than this. So stay tuned. Again, if you're a member of the National Investor, be looking probably sooner rather than later for some additions to our recommended portfolio, mostly in the energy areas I alluded to. We'll see what happens as far as the broad stock market is concerned. But again, from a purely military standpoint, it seems like this whole thing has started monumentally better than what might have happened. Militarily, it's been a great success. And I don't want to be cold in saying that, but that's just the way things are. And if that continues, then we could, of all the crazy things, see a case made by late spring, early summer for the stock market to break higher out of the trading range it's been in now for some time rather than lower. So again, that's why you don't want to make any big bets right now on the broad market's direction. You know, we'll stick as we're doing with good sectors that we like, with some individual stories that we like, and beyond that again with energy. So anyhow, those are my initial thoughts. This is going to be a moving target, needless to say, so don't go too far. And thanks for tuning in.
We're glad you joined us today. As always, write to Chris at nationalinvestor.com with your comments and questions. And be sure to visit yourmoneytoday.org if you haven't already. Sign up for our free alerts, notifications of new shows, and more. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.